everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2023, and you're listening to episode 349, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny in theaters now. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches classes in Bible exposition and systematic theology, and he also writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written a film review of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, and his review is called It's the Mileage, Looking Back on 40 Years with Indiana Jones. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on again.
Always good to be here. Thanks.
So as I said, we're going to do a deep dive into Indiana Jones, and we're going to talk about the newest installment, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. And as always, I just want to say this will be spoiler filled. So if you want to see the film first, then go ahead and see it and come back to this. Although, you know, I'm assuming most people saw the original and won't care about spoilers because it's been out for more than 30 years. But we just want to talk about kind of the whole series to start. And for those people who might not remember because it's been so long, why don't you give us a kind of broad overview of the entire Indiana Jones series?
Sure. So the Indiana Jones films really started, at least in their conception, back in the 1970s, predating Star Wars. Actually, George Lucas, the creator of Star Wars, had this idea to do a film that was, at the time, a modern version of what were called movie serials or serial films or chapter plays that were popular in the early 20th century. Now, it's been some time. It's been about 100 years. What on earth are movie serials or chapter plays? Well, back in the day, in theaters, each week there would be a chapter play that was shown, and these, at their peak, ran about 30 minutes each. And you would go to the theater, and you would watch a chapter play, and you would see a chapter of the story. And these were, traditional action adventure stories with dastardly villains and heroes and damsels in distress and that kind of a thing. And each chapter would sort of end on a cliffhanger until the story was resolved. And Lucas, and this is pretty well documented, was a big fan and of those things. He grew up watching those things. And so he had this idea that he wanted to do a modern version of that kind of adventure serial. And I think it was in the early 70s, I think it was 73, that Lucas wrote the treatment, or at the very least a version of Indiana Jones. The character was called Indiana Smith. But the concept, the idea for the character and the story really sort of predates Star Wars, which I think is very interesting. After the success of Star Wars in 77, the story goes, Lucas was in Maui with Steven Spielberg. And they were sort of talking about what they were going to do next. Spielberg had just come off of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was also a very big hit. And I've always found this interesting because I've been a huge Bond fan. Spielberg had wanted to do a Bond film. And he sort of voiced this to Lucas. And Lucas's response is that he has an idea that's better than James Bond. And he pitches this film, The Adventures of Indiana Smith, or Raiders of the Lost Ark, or what would become Raiders of the Lost Ark, to Spielberg, and Spielberg ended up loving it. And so they were sort of rock stars of the filmmaking world at the time, and they collaborated on what would become the film Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I thought it was sort of interesting that the original deal that they cut with Paramount Pictures was for 5 films back in the 70s. And that's exactly how many we got 40 years later. which I always thought was kind of interesting. So that was sort of the genesis of the idea. But the films themselves, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Last Crusade, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and now The Dial of Destiny, all follow this roguish archaeologist from the 1930s up through the 1960s named Indiana Jones. Dr. Henry Jones, who's played by Harrison Ford in all of the films. And the films have always been very popular. When Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, it was one of those films that sort of cleaned house thanks to the special effects and editing at the Academy Awards before the century was out. Within, you know, 30 years of its release, it had been selected for preservation by the Library of Congress. I mean, it was just an iconic, iconic film. And everybody knows Indiana Jones, from the John Williams score to the iconic silhouette. You know, if you see a silhouette of a man with a fedora and a whip, you know that's Indiana Jones. So it's a very popular series. It's a very well-known series. It's a very highly regarded series critically, especially that original trilogy that lasted through the 80s. And Raiders came out in 81. The Last Crusade came out in 89. And that was sort of the end of it. Spielberg, I know, has said before that, you know, he sort of designed that last shot of The Last Crusade, them riding off into the sunset, literally, as sort of the end of the series. But then they came back in 2008 to do another one. And after Lucas sold Lucasfilm to Disney, this last film, this fifth film, sort of ends the series. So that's a general overview of Indiana Jones. It's hard to believe, I think, that it's been 40 plus years since this adventure started. But that's an overview of the series and sort of what it's about.
Well, I always want to ask this question because we always get the comment that Christians shouldn't bother themselves with things that are like film or television series, that they are representing a very ungodly worldview. So why are these films ones that Christians should care about, ones you think Christians should watch? Because, of course, as I said, there's a lot of Christians who are against secular entertainment.
So I'll start broad on this and get a little more specific. Just broadly speaking, as I mentioned, these are really highly regarded films, at least the original trilogy is, and especially Raiders of the Lost Ark. Anyone who has just a passing interest in film at all should be familiar with Raiders of the Lost Ark and get to know Indiana Jones. What Lucas and Spielberg created is really sort of, you know, fascinating. Beyond that, the films contributed to the creation of the PG-13 rating. You know, this is sort of lost on people now, but, you know, beforehand you sort of just had, you know, restricted R material, which, you know, today we would probably consider, you know, much more in line with PG-13 stuff. And then you had PG. So a lot of the early James Bond films, which we look back on now and see, you know, all these innuendos and things like that, were rated PG. It was films like Indiana Jones that really contributed to the creation of a PG-13 rating, which is a rating for audiences that are not children, specifically geared toward teenagers, films that teenagers can see and like and enjoy. So these films are sort of geared toward older children, young adults, that sort of thing. And I think it's important for Christians to pay attention to that on one level, because these are films that have such a cultural presence you're not going to get away from. Again, everybody knows Indiana Jones. Whether or not you've seen the films, you've heard the theme, or you at least have seen the posters, which are very iconic, everyone sort of has an understanding of. You might not know the details of the world or the narratives or any of that, but you know the character Indiana Jones because it's just part of the culture at this point. So it's worth knowing or being aware of just for that. Whether or not Christians should see the films, as I said, I think anyone with just a passing interest in film owe it to themselves to see at least Raiders of the Lost Ark. But beyond that, in a culture that is so quickly coming unmoored from traditional heroic values in a culture that is so quickly getting away from traditional masculine heroes. Indiana Jones is sort of a relic of an older time in the best of ways. And when you watch the films, I mean, he has, you know, sort of love interest throughout the films, but there really is just sort of one individual he comes back to over and over again. And he comes to see the value of marriage and working through conflict and things like that. So I think these are mature films for young adults that are really, by modern standards, very clean. These are films that you can watch as a family, even though especially Temple of Doom and even Scenes of Raiders have some pretty dark moments to them. They're movies that can be watched as a family that are not cartoons, that are a little more taken a little more seriously than cartoons, that are not hard R films by any stretch of the imagination. So I would call them in that sense wholesome entertainment, which I feel is something that in the age of Marvel we're sort of losing. We've talked about this before with the rise of the superhero genre and this idea of, you know, very ironic and self-aware and cynical heroes. Indiana Jones is nothing like that. And so it in a lot of ways, if you've never seen Indiana Jones, if you've never encountered the character, it can come across as a breath of fresh air in a culture that is mired in irony and cynicism.
We would appreciate it if you help us to get the word out about the Christian Research Journal, that all of our great resources and articles from more than 40 years worth of publishing is now available free to everybody online at our website, equip.org. If you hit journal and you hit Christian articles, you will see more than 1,000 articles there from all the years that we've published. And it's just a wealth of resources on so many different topics that you can get the links and send them to friends, no paywall at all whatsoever. So please let people know about that and about our podcast. The other way that you can support us now that we're subscription free is to give us a tip. And you can do that if you go to quip.org, journal, Postmodern Realities Podcast. At any landing page, you will find a link where you can give us a tip. And of course, as I say every single time, please do give us a rating and review, because the more that we have, specifically on Apple Podcasts, where it seems that those aggregated there will help in search for material that people are looking for, just like the kind of content that we provide on this podcast. So if you could give a short written review as to why you listen to this podcast, we'd be very grateful. So thank you for supporting us for all these years, and thank you for getting the word out about the great resources free online for everybody from the Christian Research Journal. And now back to our conversation about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny with Cole Burgett. So I think it's really interesting that this series has been as successful as it is. Maybe it's the, you know, the kind of character that it is, and it has managed to be successful in different mediums like novels and video games and those kinds of things. So what do you think is really the ethos that it has that just resonates with people? Why is it so popular?
Yeah, there are a lot of angles to this particular question. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it is sort of timeless. It is classic in the truest sense of the word. What Lucas and Spielberg set out to do was to create a kind of hero that people could relate to. In many ways, he's sort of the antithesis of James Bond. If you look back at the Bond films of the 70s and early 80s, where Roger Moore was still in the role, I mean, Bond had almost become a parody of himself. He was sort of invincible and untouchable, and you never really worried about Bond's well-being. You never really worried about his safety. With Indiana Jones, you have a very different kind of hero. You have a hero that's relatable. And Spielberg talked at length about this and has talked at length about this over the years, that he thought the sort of the secret sauce that made Jones work was his relatability. This was a hero who got knocked down but got back up. This was a hero who could take a punch as well as he could give a punch. And so there was a sense in which you began to root for Jones because he was sort of the perpetual underdog. It's sort of encapsulated in the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark when the Ark of the Covenant is being taken and Jones makes the decision to go after it. And everyone's sort of looking to him, you know, expecting him to have this plan. And he says, I don't know, I'm making this up as I go along. That's sort of the essence of the character, that it's just adventure. It's timeless. It's classic. It's fun. And it translates well to different mediums, which I think has contributed to its longevity. When I was a kid, I remember reading some of the novels by Rob McGregor and Max McCoy. I remember those names distinctly. There were novels that were just felt like, you know, classic pulp adventure stories. I grew up reading Westerns and things like that, and these were not that far off. The other thing that I remember playing as a kid, there were video games. And, you know, these things were all coming out on the hiatus. I mean, there was a gap between 1989 and 2008 where the film series was on hiatus. And there was a television series in there in the early 90s that, you know, was sort of popular but didn't really have much of an audience. And so it didn't last that long. So in that, you know, 15, 20-year period in between, the novels and the video games and these expanded universe things were sort of sustaining the series. And it translated easily to that because it is this sort of timeless adventure story. I distinctly remember playing Indiana Jones and the Emperor's Tomb, for example, on the PlayStation 2, which was sort of a prequel to the Temple of Doom. It sort of leads directly into the Temple of Doom storyline. I thought that was kind of, you know, interesting. As a kid, I had never really seen anything like that. And at the time, Lucasfilm was heavily getting into the gaming space and experimenting there and things like that. So it's this timeless concept that translates easily into different mediums. And that versatility sort of kept the series alive between the films and brought it to a younger audience. There's a real sense in which my fondest memories of Indiana Jones come from a video game. Even though I love the films and enjoy the films, I still think very highly of the video game that I played that really sort of introduced me to the character. So that versatility, I think, has kept it popular for a long time.
Well, I want to ask you about the kind of character that Indiana Jones is, because it was a very in-depth conversation, and I would say that I would like to continue into some of those beats that we started talking about, something called metamodernism, and I want you to refresh for our listeners what that is. We talked about that on our last episode about the television series Mrs. Davis. And I want to encourage everyone to go back and listen to that because, yes, we do talk about Mrs. Davis, but there's a huge part of the podcast episode where we're talking about this new kind of storytelling called metamodernism. And it seems to me that Indiana Jones could be seen as, you know, an old-fashioned or archaic kind of hero. And these are not the kind of characters that people laud these days in our culture. And the fact that he is going after antiquities could also be seen in a poor light these days, that those kinds of artifacts should remain in the cultures from which they, you know, people will say they have been stolen by museums and are placed into museums that where they should belong to those cultures where they were taken from. So what kind of heroes do we have right now? And is that just really because we're in this kind of metamodern space and we have these new modern heroes that are not these kind of swashbuckling type of heroes of the past?
Yeah, so metamodern storytelling, which we began talking about the last time we did a review, is sort of this term that's now being used to define a lot of the stories we're seeing and explaining the warp and woof of the narrative space that stories are occupying right now. You see this embodied sort of with Everything Everywhere All at Once and Mrs. Davis especially, or where the two that two films that have brought this conversation to the fore. A metamodern approach to storytelling is going to emphasize this kind of integrated pluralism. And it digs into the plot structure itself. And this is very, very, very interesting. And we'll push this conversation further. So one of the articles that I reference in the article I wrote for you, you actually found and sent to me, is titled "The Racist Literary Origins of Indiana Jones," in which this author sort of argues that the plot structure of the Indiana Jones films themselves are borrowed from these early serials, which George Lucas has talked about, these early sort of adventure stories popularized by the likes of Johnston McCauley, who created Zorro, and H. Rider Haggard, who created Alan Quatermain. Those sorts of stories are racist. And there's no denying that a lot of the early pulps, I mean, you just look at their cover art, you can see their portrayals of especially Asian and African-American characters. I mean, it's bad. And there's no denying that. But the argument goes that the plot structure of the Jones films themselves are sort of inherently racist because they borrow from these sorts of stories. Now, what's interesting here is that there's no reading of the films contextually. There's sort of a hand-waving away of the contextual readings of the films, which is what we would call, you know, traditional storytelling methods. A plot moves forward. There are characters and dialogue and themes, and the point of the story, or the point that's being made, or the theme, quote unquote, of the story, is where the plot ends. You follow the plot from beginning to end, and where it ends is what the story is trying to say. And in these Jones films, Jones never ends up with the artifact. He's sort of always learning to let go, to deny himself, to give up. A good example of this would be in the Temple of Doom. The Sankara stones, he ends up giving them back to the people that he originally would have, you know, taken them from. So all the contextual reading is sort of put aside in favor of this discussion of plot structures, and you see this reflected in metamodern storytelling, because metamodern stories play with plot structures. We talked about this with Mrs. Davis, and I'm going into this just to by way of illustration. Mrs. Davis does not have what we would call a traditional plot structure. One of the things that you talked about, and we both agreed on in the three episodes I saw, is that there are things that contribute to the story that just don't really go anywhere. There are scenes that there doesn't really seem to be a point to. Well, in metamodern storytelling, that's sort of the thing. There's a sense of absurdity to it. And the absurdity is the point, and the fact that there's no real meaning to it is the point. Viewers are encouraged to find meaning for themselves, whatever that means. Now, the Jones films are cut from a much older cloth of storytelling, very contained, beginnings, middles, ends. And the hero that is Indiana Jones is a very different kind of hero from the heroes of this metamodern approach. What we see now are heroes who are very cynical, who are full of self-irony. It's heroes who have to sort of wink at the camera. In the article I wrote regarding Mrs. Davis, you know, one of the things that show does, and this is a hallmark of metamodern storytelling, is what is called in writing circles lampshading. So when you begin to write in a specific genre, genres come with tropes, or things that you expect to happen, whether it's fantasy, whether it's action adventure, whether it's horror, there are just things you expect to happen, tropes. And when writers use those tropes, it has become more and more common in recent years for writers to lampshade the fact that they use those tropes, or in other words, they call attention to it in the narrative of the film itself. So an example of this would be in a horror film. When characters are in a horror film, something happens, and then one of the characters looks at the others and says, "Have you guys never seen a horror movie? Don't split up." That's when bad things happen. That is lampshading the fact that the writer knows that he's writing a horror film. And though the characters are themselves in a horror film, which makes it ironic, the fact that they're sort of saying that is like a little wink and a nod to the audience. It sort of lets the audience in on the joke and lets the audience know that the writer knows they're writing a horror film. Now, when this stuff first crops up, the first time you see it, it's like, oh, that's kind of clever. And then you move on. When it becomes the dominant mode of storytelling, you actually start to lose sincerity. And this is what we started to see with Mrs. Davis, that there's very little sincerity to the storytelling anymore because the heroes are not allowed to be heroes in the sense that they're not allowed to have flaws that they're to overcome. They have to constantly wink at the audience and let the audience know it's okay to not take this too seriously. And I think one of the things that will surprise modern audiences who have never seen the Indiana Jones films is that though they are big sort of fun adventure stories, when you watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, the characters in the film take the events that are happening quite seriously. It is not a pretentious film. It's not an overblown film, but it's a serious film in that sense. It's a sincere film. It's sincere storytelling. The Temple of Doom, which is considered the darkest entry. I mean, you know, the characters take what it's there, you know, moments of high comedy there, but it's a film in which the characters take themselves and the events seriously. And it's not full of irony and the sort of winking at the camera and stuff. This is what sets Jones apart as a hero and makes him seem, I guess, what a lot of people would call very old-fashioned, is because there is still a sincerity to the storytelling. Jones is a hero who has flaws, and those flaws are both what make him relatable and are also what help him develop as a character. And so the metamodern approach to storytelling is both a completely different way of telling stories because it undoes traditional plot structures, but it also leads to very different readings of stories in general. And why do we talk about any of this? Why do we bring it up in the context of, you know, a Christian conversation? Because this stuff has very serious bearings on hermeneutics and your interpretation of Scripture. I teach courses in systematic theology and New Testament survey, Old Testament survey. I teach Bible classes, and I teach it to both high school and college levels. And one of the things I've noticed just in recent years is a skepticism toward traditional hermeneutic methods, what we might call the plain reading of Scripture or a plain reading of a text. There's great skepticism towards that. When I ask students to, you know, read sections of Romans, really I ask them to read the whole book, but when I ask them to exposit sections of Romans, tell me what Paul is talking about, they find it absolutely impossible to tell me what Paul is talking about in Paul's context, in Paul's culture, in Paul's historical situation, even though we've covered this in class. They tell me what it means to them. They tell me what they get out of the text. And in you know, biblical studies, conservative biblical studies at least, we would say that's a no-no.
Well, I mean, do you think it's partly because this generation, Gen Z, if we're speaking of high school students, it's so much what they see on social media and they're, you know, huge YouTube watchers and TikTok watchers and the like, is that they have to search for their own truth, my truth, what's true for them.
Absolutely.
What gives meaning to them. It doesn't matter what the meaning of the words were exactly, is how is anything that they're partaking in speak to them so that they can say, well, that's true for me and therefore valid.
Yes, that's a big part of it. And so the idea that storytelling would begin to shift to accommodate this new mode of thought to the degree that it's actually a new mode of thought, it isn't really that surprising. It really shouldn't surprise us all that much that we see things like Mrs. Davis or Everything Everywhere All at Once coming out and getting traction. That really shouldn't surprise us at all. But there is a connection here. between the kinds of stories we tell and we see and the cultural artifacts we export and the interpretation of Scripture. So Christians who are, you know, interested in maintaining a plain reading of the text and maintaining a contextual reading of the text, which, you know, I think is just how you read stories in general, this is something they should care about. And one of the things that makes Indiana Jones, just the entire film series, so I think important is because it's a very popular series that is very traditional in its storytelling. And I think that's worth paying attention to. And Jones as a hero is not a hero of a metamodern age. In fact, the latest film, Dial of Destiny, one of the underlying themes, it's not really dealt with too much, but it's in there, it's discussed in some of the dialogue, is that Jones is a relic. I mean, he's an old guy. In the context of the film, it's set in the late 60s. It's getting ready to transition into the 70s. I mean, Jones is a man out of time. And that becomes sort of the one of the underlying ideas of the film, is that he is literally a man out of time, and he's sort of coming to terms with that. So I think there are a lot of threads here that directly tie into hermeneutics and an interpretation of Scripture that has to do with the culture at large.
I also kind of think, before we talk about the Dial of Destiny in particular, that when you think about metamodern films that everyone, you know, the younger generation loves, and my kids are Gen Z and they love that film, and it just has also a specific way in which it tells a story. So before we saw The Dial of Destiny, we had a family movie night and watched the third movie in the Indiana Jones series. And to a teenager, it seems so slow.
And boring, yes.
Boring. And we were kind of, you know, my husband and I were like, at the end of it, like, well, yeah, did we remember it being that slow and boring? Because if you saw everything everywhere all at once, it just is, there's so many cuts into it, which, you know, it's not, that's not a new thing. We started seeing that back in MTV videos back in the day in the 80s, but it's just all these different cuts. And I think of the attention span of kids, or not even kids, adults, where, you know, before we'd be like, oh, a 3-minute video. But now, because of TikTok, it's like, if a video is 60 seconds, it's way too long. So it's this idea of even the vehicle for these metamodern stories is a certain kind of thing in and of itself as well.
Absolutely. It's interesting you make that point. I think we may have talked about this with Mrs. Davis, but when I talk with my high schoolers about what they watch and what they enjoy, you know, when they ask me, you know, what are some of your favorite films, and I start talking about them, I mean, that's the response that I get is, well, that's such a boring film. I couldn't get through it. It was so slow. And it's very hard for me to fathom someone calling an Indiana Jones film boring and slow. You know what I mean? I mean, it's fist fights and action and gunshots and you know, great, you know, pumping music. I mean, it's sort of, I feel very old.
But I mean, in the way that you're talking about it being old fashioned, I think it's the way that it tells its story is a little bit more linear and old fashioned. And to the younger person consuming entertainment today, that's just these fast cut. I mean, most, they can't sit still for even a 90-minute film, because it's hard for them, because they're used to seeing TikTok videos that are 15 seconds.
Yeah. And
so they expect you, if you want to tell me a story, you better tell it to me in 15
seconds.
Yeah.
And I think that plays directly into the sort of character development you see in a lot of these modern films. I think of Marvel especially, where at least early on, the Marvel characters had good character development, clear arcs and things like that. Less so in some of the more recent ones that I've seen. It's very hard to develop characters consistently over a span of time that requires you to pay attention. I was just talking with one of my good friends who is, her degrees are in English and things like that, love storytelling, and she was talking about the importance of watching a film or reading a book of the Bible even in one sitting. That films are meant to be watched, you know, through. And what spurred her onto this conversation was the rise of subtitles. Why do students, she said, I have so many students asking me to turn subtitles on, and they tell me that they watch everything with subtitles. And she was saying, I don't understand that. Can you not hear what they're saying? And I think that's very, very interesting.
I saw a whole article on that recently, I think in the New York Times or something like that, or about the rise of subtitles. But what is kind of funny is I tend to now, I don't know, maybe because people watch things with the sound off because of TikTok and Instagram and things like that. That's not the reason why I use subtitles, but it's like I'm so used to subtitles now. I really don't want to watch a film without subtitles, because especially if there's like accents. So recently I watched this film called Living that was nominated for various different Oscars earlier in the year, which is actually kind of almost a beat for beat reinterpretation in a different setting of an Akira Kurosawa movie and of decades ago. And I guess because of their accents or something, I had to watch it with subtitles, but I'm just so used to subtitles that I feel like it's easier to pay attention. And I definitely think that it would be harder work to not have subtitles on. So I don't know why younger people like subtitles, but I'm kind of really into them these days.
Yeah, this was new to me. I mean, I watch films with subtitles when it's in a language I can't understand.
No, I'm tending to watch everything with subtitles.
Yeah, I like see what
stuff
you're saying.
In English. Yep.
Yeah, this was news to me. So I'm learning about this myself. But it is definitely a new day and age. When it comes to storytelling and filmmaking and things like that.
So let's talk about specifically this particular film, Dial of Destiny. And so give us kind of an overview of this film, which supposedly is going to be Harrison Ford. I mean, he's what, in his early 80s or almost 80 or something?
Yeah, I would say this is it.
And what also... this is a spoiler, but honestly, really, I mean, they have like a shirtless scene with him at the beginning. I'm like, we didn't need to see an 80-year-old guy shirtless. I mean, I guess you could say, okay, he's pretty fit for 80, but I don't understand why that's in there. But anyway, what's the overall plot? Kind of bring us up to speed, because honestly, I didn't watch like Indiana Jones 4, so I didn't really know what happened.
Yeah, you messaged me and said he has a kid.
yes. Because I, you know, as I was preparing, I saw it with my son and I said to him, did you realize, like, I went back later and looked on Wikipedia or something, that, because he was kind of confused, who was that lady at the end that he was hugging? And I'm like, well, I guess Indiana Jones had some kid, but that was in 4. And my son and I looked at each other like, well, we didn't see 4. So we had no idea.
Yeah. So the new film titled The Dial of Destiny is set in primarily in 1969. And Indiana Jones he's an old guy now. It's been quite a few years since his last adventure, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, where he dealt with the Russians. And now in 1969, the story picks up. Ford is estranged from his wife, Marion. This is Marion Ravenwood from Raiders of the Lost Ark. He got back together with and married at the end of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. They had a son together named, this was the character played by Shia LaBeouf in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. They called the kid Mutt. And his son was killed in Vietnam. And that led to them being estranged. And the story picks up with a character named Helena Shaw, who is Jones's goddaughter. And she sort of comes back into his life because she's trying to locate a device that Jones and her father first went after way back in the 40s. So the beginning of the film actually starts back in the 1940s with terrible, terrible CGI of a young Harrison Ford. It very much feels like it could have been a classic Indiana Jones, a scene out of a classic Indiana Jones film out of the original trilogy. So back in 1944, they find an Antikythera mechanism, which was built by this mathematician named Archimedes. And supposedly there's this theory that it could somehow alter the course of history, change time, things like that. And Shaw is after this device. And so is this Nazi turned NASA scientist. So it's taking, you know, nods from Operation Paperclip and things like that in history. There's this Nazi turned scientist named Voller, who wants the device himself, and his plan is to go back in time, kill Hitler, and change the outcome of World War II. He wants to sort of lead the Third Reich to victory himself. And that's sort of the plot of the film in a nutshell. The story, there's an undercurrent there about time and, you know, Jones being a man out of time and having run his course and looking back on his life, and with a device like this, having the opportunity to go back and perhaps do things differently and change things here or there. That's sort of the theme and what the story is about. So there is a sense of finality to it. There is a sense in which this very much is, you know, Jones' last go round. And, you know, I guess everyone's going to get different mileage out of it. But it's a classic adventure, for better or for worse.
So you did mention, which I didn't realize, that he had a son. Is that important to, you know, what is happening in that film and then this one, and how the plot develops in Dial of Destiny because of different motivations that he has to find this, okay, basically time traveled device? And also, they, you know, when they're talking about different people from time, I was thinking, well, maybe younger kids would go back and Google that to figure out, well, who are these people in BC that are part a character in this film?
Yeah, so the story sort of kicks in, and you're catching up as you go along. You don't really know what has happened to Marion or Mutt. You know, the fourth film literally ends with the camera, you know, panning up over the wedding as they're walking out. And so it sort of has this, you know, happy ending sense. Well, when this film begins, I mean, Jones is living, he's an old man living by himself in a New York City apartment, and Marion's nowhere to be seen. You sort of get the sense that he doesn't want anything to do with her, and Mutt isn't mentioned at all. And you're sort of left to put the pieces together as the story goes along. And it kind of culminates in a scene about halfway through the film where the character of Shaw asks Jones about his sort of his motivations, you know, if it's true that this device can alter the course of history, can take one back through time, what would you do with it? And, you know, he begins talking about his son's death, knowing ahead of time that if his son goes off to war, he's going to die, and that his son goes off to war really just in an attempt to make Jones angry, which leads to, as Jones tells it, Marion not being able to cope with this and them becoming estranged and separated. So it actually is the events of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and the revelation that he has a family and that he tries to make this family work as best he can directly tie into his motivation for seeking out this dial. And one of the things that's interesting about the film is you're sort of left questioning his motivations, at least in the first half of the movie. It's sort of, this has always been the great complexity of Jones's character, is that he's kind of a selfish guy who has to learn to put aside his selfishness. And he does that in this film as well. It's his fatal flaw, so to speak, as a character, that he kind of wants to find it for the pride of it, the chance to be the guy who finds this artifact, who uncovers the secret. But in this film, the stakes are far more personal, and he's a little slower. He's a little more reserved as a character. It's less about the adventure and the excitement of the adventure, and it's more about the people that he has lost along the way. You get that scene, Antonio Banderas is in this film, who plays one of Jones's friends, and he's sort of unceremoniously and sort of unexpectedly killed, considering that he has, you know, very high billing on the movie poster. His name is,
I know, I just thought that was just, what do you call it, stunt casting. He's at the very forefront of the movie poster, and I'm like, okay, he's in this, you know, really long movie for maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, he was, he really doesn't have a ton of screen time, and you get the sense of a history between them. And his character is actually kind of interesting and compelling. Antonio Banderas is a good actor. I've always liked him. And he's there, and he's sort of killed unceremoniously. And, you know, in previous films, there's maybe a sense in which the adventure would have just sort of skipped along. But when they attempt to do this in this film with Shaw, who's, you know, coming out of this dramatic escape after his character is killed, making these wisecracks, you know, Jones sort of looks at her and says, you know, what are you doing? My friend was just killed, which is not a typical response from Jones. So there is a sense in which his character is looking back on his life, is keeping tally of his regrets, is keeping tally of the things that he has lost, including his wife, including his son. And his motivation for finding this device is wrapped up in that. So I absolutely think it's important to his character. It's important to the film as a whole. And it's important to see just how much the character has grown in the span of, you know, 40 years.
Well, speaking of 40 years, you know, this story, I guess, is now complete. And what would you say is the legacy of Indiana Jones? And, you know, ultimately, what are these films about? I mean, we've talked about how they've been old-fashioned, or their approach is old-fashioned. So is it anything that, you know, the modern Christian and modern audiences can find even helpful or significant to them to even watch these films? Like we were just mentioning, to younger people, they seem slow and boring.
Oh, absolutely. Jones, as a character, is sort of constantly learning to deny himself. He doesn't end up with the artifacts that he goes after, or he gives them back. You know, the Raiders ends with that iconic shot of the Ark just sort of being shunted into a warehouse by the government, you know, sort of wrested from Jones's control and fined. Temple of Doom ends with him giving the Sankara stones back. The Last Crusade ends with him literally stopping reaching for the Holy Grail because his father, who he nearly lost and sort of got a miraculous second chance to be with, is calling for him. He would rather let go of the treasure that he's seeking, let go of the artifact, to spend just a little more time with his dad. And Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which, you know, was sort of not extremely well liked upon release. A lot of it had to do with the terrible CGI, and I completely understand that and agree with that. But in terms of development for his character, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was hugely important. He learns that he has a son. He settles down. He tries to make it work. He tries to make this family unit work. And it's a nuclear family. I mean, he realizes that he's lost a lot of time. He realizes that he hasn't been as good of a father figure as he could, or as good of a husband as he could be. And so he tries to make it work. And now with the Dial of Destiny, which is where his story ends, we see that in a lot of ways it didn't work, that things beyond his control failed miserably. But the way this film, you know, sort of ends is he almost has to be dragged. He quite literally has to be dragged back into his present time to be given another chance with Marion. And that, like you said, that who is this woman who comes back at the end of this film that he sort of has a thing for? It's his wife, and she comes back after the adventure, and they reconcile, and he apologizes to her, and they go forward trying to make this work yet again, despite all that has gone wrong, and ultimately not being able to change history, learning to pick up the pieces and move forward. And I absolutely think those are things, values, that might seem outdated, that might seem archaic, but that Christians can really gravitate toward. And that, I think, is what makes Jones heroic. We have this idea these days that heroes are not allowed to have flaws or are not allowed to have development because there has to be a sequel. There has to be a universe. There has to be a, you know, a constant winking to the audience of it. It's an okay to not take this too seriously because it's all fictional anyway. But Jones is a very sincere character, and it's very sincere storytelling. And what makes him relatable are his flaws. The fact that he is a little bit selfish and he has to overcome that selfishness. The fact that he is angry with Marion, really for things that were as much out of her control as it was his control, and has to come to recognize his own selfishness in that and get past that and move past it. And repent, in a sense, of his selfishness. Those are values that Christians absolutely can find worth in. And, you know, the film, you know, who knows how well it will do ultimately. It was a very expensive film to make, so it has to make bukus of money just to turn profit. And, you know, we don't really know if that's going to happen at this point. You see projections that are sort of all over the place. But regardless, I think these are worthwhile films. They are certainly more worthwhile films than a lot of what is being churned out today. They're sincere films that both children and adults can enjoy. And I think for Christian parents, you could do far, far worse than introduce your children to a character like Indiana Jones.
Well, on a much lighter note, I have a fun question for Cole. Cole, it's summer, and so are you team ice cream or team s'mores?
Oh, ice cream.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always glad to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 349 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written a film review of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, which is in theaters now. His review is called It's the Mileage, Looking Back on 40 Years with Indiana Jones. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Just go there and hit Christian Articles and you will find the review. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio. And it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.